Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. There are lots of ways to learn about the people and places that shape what and who we are, our history. Our guest, Bernard Cornwell, opens some of the past to us with his internationally acclaimed historical fiction. His Richard Sharpe novels are among the 40 he's written. Mr. Cornwell has now begun a new series, this one focused on England's King Alfred the Great. But this is a lot more than simply British history to Mr. Cornwell. He believes that King Alfred's effectiveness may also reflect a larger reality. In a contest between order and chaos, Mr. Cornwell believes order has the upper hand.
Maybe it's simply the organizing principle, and that organizers are always going to do better than chaotic. I mean, the chaotic will cut a swathe, just as the Danes cut a swathe through England. And make an immense amount of noise and shed a lot of blood and start a lot of stories and make for great movies.
Well, interestingly
enough, the institutionalization is not there.
And Alfred defends England in the end by order, by building a system of defense. And that is his greatness, is the fact that he is ordered.
Bernard Cornwell writes historical fiction. Before that, he also had a very successful career at the BBC, where he was bureau chief in Northern Ireland. Mr. Cornwell's Richard Sharpe series began as novels and then had a life of its own on television. He also has avid fans for his Grail Quest series, the Nathaniel Starbuck Chronicles, the Warlord Trilogy, and many more. His book, The Last Kingdom, begins the new trilogy. It's set in King Alfred's time, when the Saxons had taken over England. The story's all the more interesting because Mr. Cornwell traces his own Northumbrian family roots back to this time and place. Bill Russell and I both greatly admire first-rate historical fiction, so we were treating ourselves as well as our listeners when we invited Mr. Cornwell to join us in this conversation.
Bernard Cornwell, Bill and I some time ago had the pleasure of being with Tibetan Buddhists who were preparing to do a mandala, the big picture that is a religious manifestation for them. And before they started with the mandala, they had a very elaborate, beautiful ceremony that was asking the spirits of the place permission to make this mandala. And at the time I thought, how very different from my tradition, how odd. But you know, as I was reading your latest, The Last Kingdom, I thought, this really isn't odd at all. We all have this sense, if we'll stop and think about it, that land, that place on which we stand on the earth, has many layers, and maybe we should be asking the spirits for permission in the present. I sort of had that feeling of, let's see, you've gone back to these very same places that seem familiar, and yet...
And yet. Well, the Danes in the book, the book is a story of the Danes fighting the Saxons, the English. The Danes did believe in the spirits and that the land had spirits. And the very common picture of a Danish longship with a dragon head. Well, I was delighted to discover that the dragon head, and indeed the beast head, whatever it was at the front and fore and aft, could be taken off. And they were taken off the ships, because when you rowed your ships into your own home fjord or wherever you came from, you didn't want the beast head to frighten the spirits of the land. But when you took your ship up some river in Ireland or England or France, then you did want to scare the spirits, so you put the beast heads back on. And I think one of the Danes are trying to take what is now England from the English, but that was only, 300 or 400 years before, the English took it from the British. And I think one of the tragedies for the British, who are now, whatever, the Welsh, the Scots, the Bretons, was, of course, they lost contact with the spirits of the land. And they to this day, the Welsh name for England is Slogia, which means the lost lands. And because when you lose a land, you lose all the stories that are associated with it. You know, that on this hill something happened, in this wood something happened. And that all goes. And maybe that's one reason why the Arthurian legends sort of lost their moorings and drifted off into the realm of myth, because the things that anchored them, the places where things really happened, people forgot they happened there because the people were driven off that land.
And you have delved into the Arthurian myths. Doesn't that give you some kind of a sense of your own place in the world?
I don't know. The stories of Arthur are so much legend, and they've been they're so malleable, and they've come so far adrift. I mean, somebody once said they lie at the taproot of British history. I'm not sure they do. I think they've drifted long off. And I think Stonehenge lies at the taproot. The Arthurian myth belongs to all mankind now.
Well, and the church, which you write about at some length in this book, the Cistercians in, what, 1100 more or less, sort of did a rewrite of the Arthurian to clean it up, make it a little less pagan.
Oh, and didn't they? I mean, one of the earliest sources for Arthur are the Welsh saints' lives. And in the lives of St. Padan, say, he's always a villain. Arthur in there is described as a robber, a would-be rapist. He's always the villain, and the saint is always the hero. And as in a good story, the villain always loses out. So there's no doubt that the early church disliked Arthur exceedingly, and of course the pretty obvious explanation for that is that Arthur was a pagan, which seems reasonable to me.
I don't know Merlin.
And yet, of course, then you have the curiosity of the Holy Grail in that. Well, the reason for that, of course, is that the Holy Grail was never in the early stories. It was always a classic Celtic cauldron search story. And sometimes, as you say, sometime in the 11th century, the cauldron was tossed out and it was replaced by the Holy Grail. And suddenly Arthur becomes this amazing English Christian when he was one of the worst enemies the English ever had, and he probably was no Christian.
Well, it's also stunningly anti-female, which is really one of the nice things about your book, because you know you have more or less fully realized women functioning in some ways and throughout the story.
Well, it's not a period, I think, in which women are naturally going to thrive, but The Last Kingdom is the first book in a series, and the series will follow the lives of Alfred the Great and of his son and of his grandson, but also of his daughter, who's been lost from history, which is very mysterious because there's been a laudable attempt to sort of put women back into their proper place in history and to find women who did good things in history and who've been written out. And Æthelflæd, who was Alfred's daughter, was known in the early 10th century as the Lady of Mercia, and she actually led armies against the Danes. She was a considerable heroine, and she's been completely forgotten. I don't think there's anything deliberate in this. I mean, much of Alfred has been forgotten. Edward has been forgotten. The grandson's been forgotten. So she went along with everybody else. So one of the joys of this series, we're a long way away, yeah, because it'll be 7 or 8 books, and this is only the first, would be to bring Æthelflæd back and to try and work out what was it that allowed a woman to flourish then. Well, obviously it helped enormously that she was the daughter of a king and that she was married to the Lord of Mercia. But even so, it's not necessarily an easy thing that she did.
Bernard Cornwell is with us and will continue to explore all of our history, including that which happens in what is now thought of as Great Britain. When we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show, Bill Russell and I invite you, and I'm sure that Bernard Cornwell does as well, to be with us when we return.